This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Joe Palca, sitting in for Ira Flatow. The giant pharmaceutical company Merck has announced that it will attempt to save money by refocusing its research efforts on common diseases such as diabetes, Alzheimer's, hardening of the arteries, obesity, cancer, and sleep disorders. You'll notice that schistosomiasis, onchocerciasis, and hookworm infection are not on that list. That's because these are among a dozen or so neglected diseases. As a group, they account for about 500,000 deaths annually. And typically, they afflict the poorest of the poor, people without gold-plated drug plans that allow them to purchase the latest drug for lowering cholesterol. In this hour of Science Friday, we'll talk about some of those neglected diseases and meet some of the people who are trying to bring the power of modern biomedical science to find affordable treatments and vaccines to end the suffering these diseases cause. We'll also be talking about malaria, a disease unknown in the United States, but one that afflicts hundreds of millions of people around the world. If you'd like to join the discussion, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. If you want more information about what we'll be talking about this hour, go to our website at www.sciencefriday.com. where you'll find links to our topic. And now let me introduce my guests. First, Peter Hotez is a professor and the chair of the Department of Microbiology, Immunology, and Tropical Medicine at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C., and principal investigator of the Human Hookworm Vaccine Initiative. I know he's had an extremely busy day already, and I want to thank him for taking the time to join us today from his office in Washington, Dr. Hotez.
My pleasure, and thank you for inviting me, Joe.
Okay, and next I've got Terry Taylor, is a university distinguished professor in the Department of Internal Medicine at the College of Osteopathic Medicine at Michigan State University in East Lansing. She joins me from the campus there. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
And Ted White is a member of the Seattle Biomedical Research Institute and a professor in the Department of Pathobiology at the University of Washington in Seattle. He joins me today from the studios of member station KUOW in Seattle. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
So, Dr. Hotez, I wonder if I could start with you. You've spent your day talking about hookworm, and I think we need to let everybody who's listening know exactly what hookworm disease is, because it used to be known in this country, but not anymore.
Well, hookworm is what is sometimes referred to as a neglected tropical disease. You mentioned a dozen or so. The number that we're coming up with is approximately 13. 13 of these tropical infections that exclusively affect the poor and the powerless generally in rural areas of low-income country. And they have, aside from the fact that they have this common feature of being exclusively linked to poverty, they are also have other features, including being stigmatizing. So often people who have one of these diseases have some disfiguring features, such as leprosy, such as river blindness, such as lymphatic filariasis, otherwise known as elephantiasis, and so that there's a stigma attached to them. And even though these diseases have many features that they do not share in common, there are enough of these features to cause us to link them together as neglected tropical diseases and now try to make renewed efforts to focus on developing new drugs, new vaccines, and new diagnostics.
So what is hookworm infection, and what does it kill you, or what happens?
Hookworm is a parasitic infection that's caused by parasitic worms. That these worms are approximately a centimeter long, so they're half an inch long. And they live attached to the small intestine where they feed on our blood. And so that an individual who's affected with hookworm suffers from intestinal blood loss because of the blood feeding habits of the worm. And as a consequence, hookworm is an important cause of anemia, especially of iron deficiency anemia in the developing world, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, Central America, South America, and Southeast Asia. And it's a particular problem among two types of populations, namely children, including school-age children, and women of reproductive age, including pregnant women.
And are there no drugs to treat hookworm?
There are drugs that have been developed to temporarily remove hookworms from the gastrointestinal tract while they're feeding on blood. So it's possible to effect temporary cure. The problem is that when you live in these impoverished villages, you can immediately get reinfected. So the studies have shown, both by WHO and other organizations, that an individual will get reinfected with hookworm within 4 to 6 months. So that while the drugs are temporarily effective, they do nothing to prevent the long-term consequences of reinfection. And as a consequence, if you're a child living in a developing country, you effectively live with hookworms in your intestinal tract throughout your childhood.
And what are you trying to do to change that?
So we've looked at this situation and said, well, wouldn't it be great if instead of having to rely on drugs that have to be administered constantly to a child over his entire lifespan while he's in school every few months, wouldn't it be great to make a vaccine to actually prevent reinfection? The idea being maybe you give the drug once to deworm these children, but then subsequently vaccinate in order to not obligate us to administer the drugs for several years so that we can keep children with reduced numbers of hookworms in their intestine for long periods of time.
Okay. Terry Taylor, your work mostly focuses on malaria. Do you think of that as a neglected disease? I mean, the neglected disease community thinks everybody knows about malaria, but what does the malaria community think?
The malaria community actually feels pretty fortunate at the moment because while we're in the category of neglected diseases, we're a much less neglected disease than many others. It's our star rose when Jeffrey Sachs coordinated a number of economic analyses and began to convince policymakers that malaria is a serious force in terms of destabilizing entire economies. It's that prevalent. And so malaria has been able to sort of rise above the fray because of the economic impacts it creates in the societies it affects.
And what the consequence of this higher profile, what have they been?
Malaria has been fortunate in attracting funding from a number of different international sources, including the Gates Foundation and the Global Fund for HIV, TB, and malaria. And as a result, countries have been able to apply for support for prevention and treatment programs that can be affected at national levels.
Okay, and tell us a little bit about your part of this. You are traveling back and forth to Malawi, as I understand it.
Right. My work is at the sort of the high end of the disease. 1 to 2 million children die every year of malaria, and they principally die of a complication of the infection known as cerebral malaria. So our work has sort of begins when children are admitted to the hospital with severe and complicated malaria, whereas the programs that I was mentioning earlier are programs that are designed to prevent severe infection and to treat infections at an early stage, hopefully preventing kids from progressing to the stage that we've been involved in studying.
Well, where are we with a vaccine? Because it seems to me, I recall, more than a decade ago, there was a promising vaccine that had been brought up by a Colombian scientist named Patarroyo, I think. And that received a lot of attention, but we don't hear about that anymore.
You know, the interesting thing about a malaria vaccine is that nature does a fantastic job of immunizing, in a way, the population. The reason that African children are at the highest risk of severe and complicated malaria is because they've not yet been exposed to enough bites from infected mosquitoes to develop immunity. And so they remain at risk and susceptible of developing severe disease. But people in endemic areas, i.e. most of sub-Saharan Africa, who survive beyond the age of 8 or 9, remain at risk of becoming infected, but don't die. They don't develop a severe and complicated disease. And this epidemiology is incontrovertible. It occurs across the board, across the continent. And it's this fact that immunity can be acquired naturally and protect people from dying of the disease that is sort of galvanized the whole vaccine effort. And there was a lot of excitement about Manuel Pedroia's vaccine. It didn't hold up when in African trials. It looked good in South America, and it wasn't as good in Africa, which is not surprising given the variability in the disease. Recent studies in Mozambique, though, have been quite encouraging, and so the malaria community is watching with interest to see how the latest vaccine candidate develops.
And this is a new recombinant vaccine that's been developed jointly by Walter Reed Army Institute of Research and GlaxoSmithKline, and it actually builds on some discoveries that a group of scientists at New York University made during the 1970s and 1980s, and it's been refashioned in such a way that it looks very exciting for protecting the most vulnerable children with malaria. Those are children between the ages of 1 and 5.
Okay, Dr. Hotez, thanks for that. Ted White, can I turn to you and get your definition of a neglected disease? Is it the same as just Dr. Hotez mentioned about poverty and these 13 diseases?
Well, I would agree that all the 13 that he's listed are the ones we've mentioned so far, are all neglected diseases. But we have to deal with the issue of, is a neglected disease one that is not responsible for a lot of deaths, or is a neglected disease malaria, which is one of the 3 or 4 top killers in the world? We have to deal with issues of, is a neglected disease one that isn't, where there isn't good therapies and good vaccines, or is it where we can't get the known vaccines and therapies to the people in the rural areas of sub-Saharan Africa and South America? All of those contribute to what is a neglected disease.
And what does it take to bring a neglected disease to the attention of the American people, or to the attention of scientists for that matter?
Well, part of it is if the neglected disease actually encroaches upon the United States, where people are actually getting sick here in the United States, or press reports, et cetera, from sub-Saharan Africa. But
Ted White, I'm sorry, I started you on a long answer, and we don't have enough time. So we have to take a short break, but we'll come back to you for the rest of that answer. Don't go away. We'll be back after a short break, and you'll hear what Ted White had to say. From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday, and I'm Joe Palca. We're talking this hour about neglected diseases and diseases that affect a lot of people in the world, just not that many in the United States. And Ted White, who's from the Seattle Biomedical Research Institute, was starting to explain how you get people to pay attention to these diseases when we had to take a break. So, Ted White, if I could invite you to finish that that thought.
Well, I think there's a bunch of factors which contribute to the American recognition of these diseases. One is, as we become a global economy, more and more of what's going on in sub-Saharan Africa has an effect on our economy and the Americans. In addition, global travel has had a huge effect. The possibility that someone from sub-Saharan Africa could get on a plane and be in the United States within a few hours and carry with them a neglected disease and spread it in the U.S. is a tremendous risk, and so we as Americans, as part of the global community, have to deal with that possibility more and more as travel, urbanization, deforestation become issues in these countries.
Well, if nothing else, SARS must have brought that to the national consciousness, because people think that originated in Asia and made its way probably by airplane to this part of the world.
Absolutely. Go ahead. Although we should keep in mind that SARS was a very limited outbreak in North America, very few people in Toronto, whereas some of these diseases, if they got into the U.S., could have a much larger effect than SARS actually had a small effect, and we heard a lot about it. If one of these diseases got loose in the U.S., it could have significant effects.
Got it. Okay.
This is Peter. I will say that the profile of global health problems has been greatly elevated over the last 5 years. And partly that's due to advocacy of some very important celebrities such as Bono, Bob Geldof. Now you have Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt talking about global health issues. It is interesting, and of course, and Terry Taylor mentioned Jeffrey Sachs, whose advocacy has been extremely important, as well as the physician Paul Farmer. And there's been a lot of emphasis, particularly on what we sometimes call the Big Three. The Big Three refers to HIV, AIDS, malaria and tuberculosis. I think one of the problems that those of us who worked on these neglected tropical diseases face is that sometimes the impression is given is that's all that's out there is HIV, AIDS, TB, and malaria. But there is a fourth leg to this table that we are only now beginning to appreciate how important these are, and these are these neglected tropical diseases. So these 13 diseases we now recognize are very important both in terms of deaths but also in terms of disability that they cause. And for that, we use a metric which is sometimes referred to as the DALY. It stands for Disability Adjusted Life Years. It refers to the number of life years lost either from premature death or from disability. And now that we have a metric for disability, we're able to really articulate how important these neglected diseases are. And the evidence is emerging that when we look at the amount of adverse health that these neglected diseases cause, they're actually almost as important as HIV, AIDS, as TB, or as malaria, so that we're no longer talking now about the big three, but I believe in the coming year you're going to see evidence that we really should be talking about the gang of four, and that fourth being the neglected tropical diseases.
Well, I'd like to turn now to a study that was presented this week at a meeting that was here in Washington of the American Society of Tropical Medicine and Hygiene. The study looked at a disease called toxoplasmosis, and this might be familiar to some people because it's the litter box disease. It's transmitted to humans through cat feces. Toxoplasmosis is most dangerous to fetuses and people with weakened immune systems. Now, scientists have discovered another vulnerable population, sea otters, along the California coast are washing up on beaches in large numbers, many of them infected with toxoplasmosis. So how did they contract the parasite? What does the presence of this disease in otters say about the health of the environment? And could knowing that how sea otters got infected tell scientists something about how people worldwide contract toxoplasmosis? Well, joining me now to talk about this study is Patricia Conrad, a professor of parasitology at the Wildlife Health Center at the School of Veterinary Medicine at the University of California, Davis. And Dr. Conrad joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Joe.
So there's this problem. These sea otters in California were dying. I mean, can you set the scene a little bit?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if you've seen these southern sea otters along the coast of California. Anyone who has knows what charismatic, playful creatures they are and may not realize that this is actually a federally listed threatened species of otters whose population was almost made extinct by the fur trade in the 1800s. And since they gained protected status in 1977, their population has gradually increased. But over the last few years, it's been stagnant, their population growth rate. And it's way below what we'd expect for the number of sea otters that we could support in California, which has been estimated up to the tens of thousands. And in fact, at last count, there's only 2,800 some sea otters along the coast of California. And that's of great concern to people in California and I think nationwide.
So what role do we think that toxoplasmosis is playing, if any, in the declining numbers of sea otters?
Well, it's turned out that this little single-cell parasite is actually a major cause of death in sea otters. We did a study looking at all of the fresh dead sea otters that were recovered from the coast of California between 1998 and 2004. And during that period, 16% of the otters that died, the cause of death was found to be toxoplasmosis. And that was based on not just finding the parasite, but also on very, very severe brain disease that was found in these otters.
So is finding out that sea otters are becoming infected with this this parasite, does it tell you anything about how humans might be getting it?
Oh, very importantly, because the thing about sea otters, well, they, like most warm-blooded animals, including humans, are what we call intermediate hosts of the parasite. They get infected and they have parasites in their tissues. And so when we think of ways that these kinds of hosts, whether sea otters or humans, might get infected, it would be either by eating other hosts, intermediate hosts that have parasites in their tissues. And we know sea otters don't eat any warm-blooded animals. So we know they're not getting infected that way. So the other most likely way that these hosts can get infected is by ingesting these little tiny egg-like oocysts that are shed in the feces of cats. Cats, wild and domestic, are the only animals that are able to produce these highly infective egg-like oocysts and shed them in their feces. So we think that's the most likely way that sea otters are getting infected.
Wow. So, I mean, and is there anything from that that you can learn about how to prevent the disease in humans?
Oh, yeah. What's important about that, Joe, is that we thought for a long time that most of the infection in some areas was coming from infected meat. But a lot has been done in the past decade to reduce the meat in the United States that has toxoplasma infection, which used to be pork. Now that's not a problem. So what this does is alerts us to the fact that these oocysts shed in the feces of cats are probably in the environment in greater numbers than what we expected. That's one lesson. And that they're also getting into waterways. Our studies showed that it was actually freshwater outflow runoff coming into the ocean that was the major risk factor or most likely way that these sea otters were getting infected. And this is a new appreciation of this in the United States. We've seen other human outbreaks of toxoplasmosis in Brazil and in Vancouver that were due to waterborne transmission of these oocysts, but I don't think there's been that same level of awareness that could happen in the United States.
Well, thanks for talking with us today, Dr. Conrad. It's an amazing story. Ted White, you were just starting to say?
Yeah, I was going to ask, in humans, toxoplasmosis is usually associated with immune-compromised people, such as AIDS patients, bone marrow transplant patients. Is there any indication that the otters are also immune-compromised, or is this in otherwise healthy otters?
Well, it's the primary animals that are dying are healthy, prime-age adult animals. We can't rule out the possibility that they're under stress due to other factors. But so far, we don't have any clear evidence of that. But the other population I just wanted to add is, besides immune-compromised people, immunologically normal people who get infected with toxoplasma can have a flu-like syndrome. They probably never get diagnosed as having toxoplasma. They just think they have flu. But the other point, Joe, you made earlier on, pregnant women are the other ones who need to be aware of this parasite because if they get infected during pregnancy, it can affect their fetus and the newborn.
All right. Interesting. Thanks again. Thanks, Dr. Conrad, for joining us.
Thank you.
Patricia Conrad is a professor of parasitology at the Wildlife Health Center at the School of Veterinary Medicine at the University of California, Davis. And I'd like to welcome back my other guest. You just heard from Ted White. He's a member of the Seattle Biomedical Research Institute and a professor in the Department of Pathobiology at the University of Washington in Seattle. We are also talking with Terry Taylor, University Distinguished Professor in the Department of Internal Medicine at the College of Osteopathic Medicine at Michigan State University in East Lansing, and Peter Hotez, who's professor and chair of the Department of Microbiology, Immunology, and Tropical Medicine at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C. And Ted White, I'm just one thing that Dr. Conrad said that just seems amazing to me is, can it really be that somehow cat feces are getting into the ocean in sufficient numbers to produce enough of these tiny egg-like things that they could be infecting sea otters?
Absolutely. I mean, it doesn't take much of these diseases to infect a population. Once it's in the population, the chances are that it could be spread within the population. There's another example of a fungal infection going around in Vancouver Island that is spreading to some porpoises that also may be the fungus washing out into the ocean. So it's clearly not unprecedented that there may be infections like this. That, I mean, sterile water, a good water supply, an uncontaminated water supply is very important to prevent a variety of infectious diseases.
Joe, it's worth.
Yes.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Peter Hotez.
Just going to point out that there are an estimated 60 million cases of toxoplasmosis in the United States. So roughly 1/4 to 1/5 of the entire U.S. population is infected with this parasite. So that we know that it's fairly ubiquitous in the environment, and it's not at all a rare infection. Now, in France, interestingly enough, there's an 80 to 90% infection rate, so it's worth looking at what are the differences between France and the United States.
Surely. Terry Taylor, you were going to say something.
Yeah, I just wanted to chime in and underscore the importance of a good public health system, because, in fact, malaria used to be a huge problem in this country. The reason that the Centers for Disease Control is in Atlanta and not in Washington, D.C., along with most other federal agencies, is because, in part, it started out as a malaria control bureau in the southern U.S., and we regularly have malaria imported to this country, and occasionally we have people infected in this country who've never left because mosquitoes here were infected by individuals arriving in the States with malaria, and it's because we can identify those cases and treat them so quickly that we forestall epidemics of malaria here.
All right. We're talking this hour about tropical diseases, neglected diseases, diseases that we typically don't hear too much about in this country. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. I'm Joe Palca, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's take one of your calls now. Let's go to Gordon in San Jose. I hope it's San Jose, California. Gordon, welcome to the program.
Hi. I have a question about the consequence of assuming these diseases could be eradicated or almost eradicated, for example, in third world countries. And my question is, will the birth rates drop when the death rates, say, from malaria drop too? And if they don't drop, could we possibly turn a disease problem into a starvation problem? I think Huxley wrote about this years ago.
Gordon, yeah, that's an interesting question. Terry Taylor, perhaps, as a malaria person?
Well, the experience elsewhere in the world has been that when the infant or child mortality rate drops, the birth rate, a drop in the birth rate follows. It's called a demographic transition, and it's been seen in many other parts of the world. There hasn't really been a sustained enough impact on malaria in anywhere in Africa yet to know if that would happen, but it certainly has happened elsewhere.
Okay, Terry, Gordon, thanks. Go ahead.
Terry, is there any indication in the 70s when malaria was semi under control with DDT, was there any adjusted birth rate changes in the 70s?
Not that I know of, Peter. I haven't seen any. There may be data out there, but I haven't seen those data.
Okay, Gordon, thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Patrick from Tucson, Arizona. Patrick, welcome to the program.
Hey, earlier in the program I heard two of the tropical diseases of the 13 diseases were river blindness and elephantitis. And I just wanted to point out that Merck actually has a vaccine called Mectizan that they have that they donate to countries who need this.
Oh, that's interesting, and I guess it's also true that they came up with the drug ivermectin, which was, or they were using that drug for donating it for river blindness. But Peter Hotez, what about Merck? Have they been? Did I unfairly single them out at the start of the program?
What Merck has done is nothing less than extraordinary. It's not really a vaccine. Mectizan is ivermectin, and what happened?
Oh, okay.
What happened was, Merck actually developed this drug, Mectizan. Much earlier, and it turned out it was developed not for human disease, it was developed for veterinary disease. So unlike these neglected diseases, which have no commercial markets, parasites of sheep and cattle are a huge market. So Merck was making $1 billion a year on Mectizan, on ivermectin, in order to deworm cattle and sheep. It was then discovered that these drugs were also effective either for the treatment or for the control of lymphatic filariasis or onchocerciasis. And what then CEO Roy Vagelis did for Merck in an extraordinary gesture was to arrange and broker a donation program where Merck will give this drug away free of charge to those who need them for river blindness or for lymphatic filariasis for as long as they're needed. And it's really one of the great success stories in tropical medicine and an example of the first private-public partnership to solve these problems. But there is another side to that, because it really points out the problem of ever persuading a drug company to actually carry our research and development on specifically for tropical diseases.
Peter Hotez, we have to stop there because we need to take a short break. We're talking about tropical diseases, and we'd like to get your calls. Our number is 800-989-8255, and we'll be back after a short break. We're talking this hour about neglected diseases. My guests are Ted White. He's a member of the Seattle Biomedical Research Institute and a professor in the Department of Pathobiology at the University of Washington in Seattle. Peter Hotez is the professor and chairman in the Department of Tropical Medicine at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C. And Terry Taylor, she's university distinguished professor in the Department of Internal Medicine at the College of Osteopathic Medicine at Michigan State University in East Lansing. We'd be delighted to take your calls. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And let's go now to Kelly from North Carolina. Kelly, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thank you very much, and I appreciate you taking my call.
Sure.
I know someone who just in the last 2 months was diagnosed with I think it's called ocular toxoplasmosis, and she has gone blind in one eye, and she has no history of any kind of immune-compromising diseases or anything. She's a perfectly healthy person, and she's lost her sight in one eye. And I'm just curious whether a disease like this, whether it goes unchecked, whether it might start to manifest itself in people who are, you know, otherwise healthy individuals.
Interesting question, Kelly. Peter Hotez, maybe you know something about the answer to it?
Well, it turns out that when babies are, I don't know, I can't really address this specific instance, but it turns out that when babies are born with congenital toxoplasmosis, which is all too common in the United States because we do not have a good newborn screening system in place, even though it's technically feasible. When babies are born with congenital toxoplasmosis, often they have no symptoms at birth. But the parasite does have a predilection for the eye and causes inflammation in the retina, and that's called retinitis and sometimes called chorioretinitis, so that often as children age, they subsequently go on to develop blindness in one eye. And unfortunately, it's a preventable form of it is a potentially preventable form of blindness because if it's recognized, it could be treated. But all too often in the United States, we miss it until it's too late.
Okay. Well, thank you. Appreciate
Kelly,
Kelly,
thanks. Yes, thanks for the call. Let's go now to Tyla. Tyla from Phoenix, Arizona, I presume. Tyla,
hi.
Welcome to
yeah,
the program.
I'm in Phoenix. Nice and warm
okay.
here today.
Good.
I had a
What's
a
your question?
Yeah. Well, I had a couple of comments. In becoming involved with an orphanage in Kampala, Uganda, we were looking at malaria treatment, and I became aware of a biotechnology firm out of Berkeley called Amyris Biotechnologies, and I can't remember the gentleman's name running that study, but he's using the compound produced from Artemisia annua. He's using E. coli to create this compound that has about 100% efficacy rate against, I presume it's already, cases of malaria. It's not prophylactic, but I wondered if you were aware of that study.
Well, let me ask Terry Taylor. Are you aware? I guess you must know about Artemisia.
Yeah, the artemisinins are a fantastic new advance in the treatment of malaria, and this particular project is a very interesting undertaking. I think the scientist you may be thinking of is Jay Kiesling, who is a chemical engineer at Berkeley, and he's worked out a way to introduce enzymes into E. coli to make a number of different compounds. So he's focusing the attention of his lab on developing a microbially engineered artemisinin. And one of the reasons this would be helpful is because at the moment the only source of the raw product is the plant, Artemisia annua. And it's in short supply. In fact, the amount of artemisinin that can be produced from the plants that are under cultivation at the moment are not enough to supply patients in sub-Saharan Africa. So this microbially engineered artemisinin would help relieve the bottleneck in that level of the supply of the drug.
But Terry Taylor, I wonder if I can ask you, if you've got this, if this bioengineering method is effective, isn't it going to be too expensive? I mean, you know, bioengineered products tend to cost more often than their natural equivalents.
This particular product is being developed in conjunction with one of these public-private partnerships called One World Health, with support from the Gates Foundation. And already there have been preferential pricing agreements set in place so that the eventual product will be affordable for the end users, which are malaria-afflicted individuals in Africa.
Well, this is interesting because I've often wondered whether, you know, this high-tech world of genetic medicine and genomics is ever going to be useful for bringing understanding or for treating these diseases. But I understand, Ted White, that your institute just solved the complete genomes of three trypanosomes, a kind of a parasite that's very prevalent in Africa. And is that going to really be useful, do you think, for dealing with these diseases?
Absolutely. Our institute did just sequence three different trypanosomes, which are single-celled organisms living in Africa, causing disease in Africa. And one of the immediate things is that you can look at the genome of these organisms and look at pathways and processes that are unique to those trypanosomes and aren't found in human cells. And therefore, you can look at pathways, you can target pathways that aren't and develop drugs against those pathways that wouldn't have an effect on human beings, but would be very specific to those pathogens. There's other ways of looking at the genome to identify antigens. The way to make a vaccine is to identify proteins in these organisms that could be a good target for vaccines, and yet those proteins also aren't found in humans, and therefore you could develop a vaccine that's, again, specific for trypanosomes or other parasitic diseases. So the genomic sequences of the microbes is an incredibly useful next step, but it is only a foundation. You have to do a tremendous amount of research to identify the compound, a drug or a vaccine. The other thing that's important is the genomic sequence of the insect vectors. Many of these parasitic diseases in sub-Saharan Africa are transferred by mosquitoes, tsetse flies, sand flies, and the genomic sequences of these is also an important in trying to look at vector control rather than microbe control.
So in other words, if you had the complete genetic sequence of a mosquito that transmits malaria, you might learn how to keep it from becoming infected with the malaria parasite or something like that?
That is available at this point in time, largely available at this point in time.
Interesting. And so why isn't it being used in the field?
Well, the genomic sequence is available. The question is to do the research to identify.
Oh, I see. Oh, I'm sorry. Maybe I misunderstood. I thought you meant the mosquitoes were available for that were resistant to the malaria parasite. But maybe those are coming along as well. Terry Taylor, have I read something about that?
There is a lot of work going on at various aspects of attacking the mosquito vector, and having the Anopheles genome will greatly help in that effort.
Okay, let's take another call. Go ahead, Peter Hotez.
I just wanted to say that sadly what's happened is we're in a situation now where our technology to mine the genome in order to develop new drugs for diseases such as African trypanosomiasis, African sleeping sickness, has outpaced our social institutions that we have in order to work with pharmaceutical companies to actually fashion them into new products. So, for instance, the treatment of choice for African sleeping sickness was a drug developed in the 1930s called Milarsoprol. It actually contains arsenic in it, and the goal for treatment of the late stages of African sleeping sickness is essentially to arsenic poison the patient, and you hope you can arsenic poison the parasite before you arsenic poison the patient. But unfortunately, the drug itself is toxic and can kill the patient around 5 to 10% of the time. Now, could we now mine the genome that we have available through the work of the Seattle Biomedical Research Institute and the Institute for Genomics Research in order to make new drugs? Well, of course we could. We just don't have a good mechanism for incentivizing companies to take that next step and now develop them into new drugs.
And to put that in perspective, in the last since 1975, so that's 30 years. There have been about 1,250 drugs introduced, and only 12 of those, so 1%, have targeted tropical diseases. So we're woefully underdeveloping drugs for these diseases that are affecting significant numbers in Sub-Saharan Africa and other places in the world.
You're absolutely right. MSF, Doctors Without Borders, did a study of all the drugs in the pipeline in the year 2000, and there was only one for a neglected tropical disease, as opposed to 8 of them for erectile dysfunction, 4 for sleep disorders, and 7 for obesity. So we really have a good sense of where the priorities are.
And another point about that is drug companies like, I mean, if you're a drug company, one of the things you'd like to do is develop a drug that people will take for long periods of time. And what we're talking about here in many cases are drugs that would be used to treat a patient, cure a patient, hopefully within a few weeks or months, and then the patient hopefully wouldn't need to take the drug again. And so that decreases the profitability of some of these drugs considerably, in addition to the fact that we're dealing with drugs for a third world population that can barely live on a dollar a day. So
it sounds like a different kind of business model is called for. But let's take another call. Bert from Oakland, California. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. This question I've been wondering about for quite a while. Laura Garrett, I read a couple of her books, and one of the books, I seem to remember that the World Health Organization had almost eradicated the malaria, but they were a year away from doing it or something like that, and the funds were cut. And then in one of the other books or the same book, I seem to remember the book saying that if they got rid of the malaria in the mosquito would be healthier and there were worse problems that would come forward after they got rid of the malaria. Is there any truth to any of that?
Terry Taylor, maybe you recall that part of medical history?
The World Health Organization did make a concerted effort to bring malaria under control in the 50s and early 60s and actually made giant strides in many parts of the world. But the intensity of malaria transmission in Africa is orders of magnitude higher than anywhere else in the world. And Africa was just refractory to that concerted effort back in the 50s. In addition, the application of DDT, which had been highly effective in other parts of the world, sort of fell into disfavor. And there's been an ongoing debate about the use of DDT in mosquito control versus its environmental effects that has sort of curtailed a lot of the malaria control efforts in sub-Saharan Africa.
Bert, thanks for that call. I just want to say thanks to Bert for that call and remind people that we're talking about tropical diseases and we're taking your calls at 800-989-8255. I'm Joe Palka, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Ted White, did you have a comment to make there?
The other factor I'm sure Terry's well aware of is drug resistance started arriving in the early 60s and on into the 70s. And drug resistance is another reason why the large malaria control efforts of the 60s and 70s weren't as successful as we had hoped.
Absolutely.
Okay. Let's take one more call now from Jennifer in Portland, Oregon. Jennifer, welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call. I hope my question is appropriate. I thought I had heard you say that you were talking about tropical diseases and neglected diseases. Is that correct? Because I don't want to waste your time.
No, that's it. Go ahead.
I'm in the veterinary industry, and as a veterinary physician, and I also work for a diagnostic company. And there's a lot of talk right now about leptospirosis, and there have been a few outbreaks that have been publicized, but I'm curious about the human incidence of leptospirosis around the country. And
okay, hold on. Before you go any farther, Peter Hotez, can you tell us what leptospirosis is?
Sure. Leptospirosis is a bacterial infection, and it's a very interesting-looking bacteria. It looks like a corkscrew,
and it has quite an interesting motion. And it can cause a disease that will cause jaundice, where you turn yellow, and it causes liver problems and can even cause meningitis. And in many respects, it resembles a viral disease called yellow fever, so much so that the person who first claimed he had discovered the cause of yellow fever had actually isolated these corkscrew organisms, which are Leptospira. And it's a particular problem in filthy slums where there's lots of overcrowding and poor levels of hygiene. So it's a disease that you find very commonly, for instance, in the favelas in Brazil and in Salvador. And in
so, Jennifer, if you want to ask a quick question because we're almost out of time,
is it your question whether it's incidents in this country?
Okay,
yeah,
thanks for that.
Because I've heard of some cases of young people dying from this when I've spoken with clients.
Oh, sure. It definitely occurs in the United States. It's not as common as it is in many developing countries, but we do see cases every year.
Okay.
Within the United States.
Well, we're going to have to. Go ahead quickly, Ted White.
There's a relatively high number in Hawaii, so it's actually, of the United States, Hawaii seems to be one place where it's relatively high compared to the rest of the
States.
Okay,
well, we have to leave things at that point because we're out of time. I'd like to thank my guest this hour, Ted White is a member of the Seattle Biomedical Research Institute and professor in the Department of Pathobiology at the University of Washington in Seattle. We also heard from Peter Hotez, professor and chair of the Department of Microbiology, Immunology, and Tropical Medicine at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C., and principal investigator of the Human Hookworm Vaccine Initiative, and Terry Taylor, university distinguished professor at the Department of Internal Medicine at the College of Osteopathic Medicine at Michigan State University in East Lansing. Thanks to all of you. Kimberly Jones is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Matt Galick in New York and Linda Mack and Walter Hassett in Washington, D.C. Greg Smith composed our theme music. We had help today from NPR librarians Key Molesky and Alphonse Vinn. If you have comments or questions, write to us at Science Friday, 55 West 45th Street, 4th floor, New York, New York, 10036. For email, the address is scifry@npr.org. Check out sciencefriday.com for more information and links to today's program. You can listen to past editions of Science Friday online or take them with you from the iTunes Music Store. And check out Science Friday's Kids Connection, free curriculum materials for teaching science using Science Friday. Just click on the teachers link on sciencefriday.com. Ira Flato will be back next week for NPR News in Washington. I'm Joe Palca.